Chapter 35. We sat in the idling Caprice for a long minute, saying nothing. The car must have had $10,000 of stakeout duty on it, from its previous life in Chicago or New Orleans or wherever. Every pore of every interior surface was thick with sweat and odor and exhaustion. Grime was crusted everywhere. The floor mats had separated into hard tufts of fiber, each one like a flattened pearl. Devereaux said,
"I apologize."
I said, "For what?"
"For asking you to help me. It wasn't fair. Forget I said anything."
"Okay."
"Can I let you out somewhere?"
I said, "Let's go talk to Janice Mae Chapman's nosy neighbors."
"No," she said. "I can't let you do that. I can't let you turn against your own people."
"Maybe I wouldn't be turning against my own people," I said. "Maybe I would be doing exactly what my own people wanted me to do all along. Because maybe I would be helping Monroe, not you. Because he might be right, you know. We still have no idea who did what here." "We." She didn't correct me. Instead, she said,
"But what's your best guess?"
I thought about the limousines scurrying in and out of Fort Kellum, carrying expensive lawyers. I thought about the exclusion zone and the panic in John James Fraser's voice on the phone from the Pentagon, Senate liaison. I said, "My best guess is it was a Kellum guy."
"You sure you want to take the risk of finding out for sure?"
"Talking to a man with a gun is a risk. Asking questions isn't." I believed that then, back in 1997. Janice Mae Chapman's house was 100 yards from the railroad track, one of the last three dwellings on a dead-end lane a mile south and east of Main Street. It was a small place, set back in a wedge-shaped yard off of a circular bulge where traffic could turn around at the end of the street. It was facing two other houses, as if it was 9 o'clock on the dial, and they were 2 and 4. It was maybe 50 years old, but it had been updated with new siding and a new roof and some diligent landscaping. Both of its neighbors were in a similar state of good repair, as had been all the previous houses on the street. Clearly, this was Carter Crossing's middle-class enclave. Lawns were green and weed-free. Driveways were paved and uncracked. Mailbox posts were exactly vertical. The only real estate negative was the train, but there was only one of those a day. 1 minute out of 1,440. Not a bad deal. Chapman's house had a full-width front porch, roofed over for shade, railed in with fancy millwork spindles, and equipped with a matched pair of white rocking chairs and a rag mat in various muted colors. Both her neighbors had the exact same thing going on, the only difference being that both their porches were occupied, each by a white-haired old lady wearing a floral print house dress and sitting bolt upright in a rocker and staring at us. We sat in the car for a minute, and then Devereaux rolled forward and parked right in the middle of the turnaround. We got out and stood for a second in the afternoon light. "Which one first?" I asked.
"Doesn't matter," Devereaux said. "Whichever. The other one will be right over within about 30 seconds.
Which is exactly what happened. We chose the right-hand house, the one at 4 o'clock on the dial, and before we were 3 steps onto its porch, the neighbor from the 2 o'clock house was right behind us. Devereaux made the introductions. She gave the ladies my name and said I was an investigator from the Army. Up close, the ladies were slightly different from one another. One was older, the other was thinner. But they were broadly similar. Thin necks, pursed lips, halos of white hair. They welcomed me respectfully. They were from a generation that liked the army and knew something about it. No question they had had husbands or brothers or sons in uniform. World War II, Korea, Vietnam. I turned and checked the view from the porch. Chapman's house was neatly triangulated by her two neighbors, like a focal point, like a target. The two neighbors' porches were exactly where the infantry would set up machine gun nests for effective enfilade fire. I turned back, and Devereaux ran through what she had already discussed. She asked for confirmation of every point and got it. All negative. No, neither of the two ladies had seen Chapman leave her house on the day she had died. Not in the morning, not in the afternoon, not in the evening. Not on foot, not in her car, not in anybody else's car. No, nothing new had come to either one of them. They had nothing to add. The next question was tactically difficult, so Devereaux left it to me. I asked, "Were there intervals when something could have happened that you didn't see? In other words, just exactly how nosy are you? Were there moments when you weren't staring at your neighbor?" Both ladies saw the implication, of course, and they clucked and pursed and fussed for a minute, but the gravity of the situation meant more to them than their wounded feelings, and they came out and admitted that, no, they had the situation pretty much sewn up around the clock. Both liked to sit on their porches when they weren't otherwise occupied, and they tended to be otherwise occupied at different times. Both had bedrooms at the front of their houses, and neither tried to sleep until the midnight train had passed. And then afterward, both were light sleepers anyway, so not much escaped them at night, either. I asked, "Was there usually much coming and going over there?" The ladies conferred and launched a long, complicated narrative that threatened to go all the way back to the American Revolution. I started to tune it out until I realized they were describing a fairly active social calendar that about half a year ago had settled into a month-on, month-off pattern. First of social frenzy, and then of complete inactivity. Feast or famine. Chapman was either never out or always out. First 4 or 5 weeks in one condition, and then 4 or 5 weeks in the other. Bravo Company in Kosovo. Bravo Company at home. Not good. I asked, "Did she have a boyfriend?" "She had several," they said with prim delight. "Sometimes all at once. Practically a parade." They listed sequential glimpsed sightings, all of polite young men with short hair, all in what they called dungaree pants, all in what they called undershirts, some in what they called motorcycle coats. Jeans, T-shirts, leather jackets. Soldiers, obviously, off duty. Not good. I asked, "Was there anyone in particular? Anyone special?" They conferred again and agreed a period of relative stability had commenced 3 or perhaps 4 months earlier. The parade of suitors had slowed, first to a trickle, and then it had stopped altogether and been replaced by the attentions of a lone man, once again described as polite, young, short-haired, but always inappropriately dressed on the many occasions they had seen him. Jeans, T-shirts, leather jackets. In their day, a gentleman called on his bell in a suit and a tie. I asked, "What did they do together?" "They went out," the ladies said, "sometimes in the afternoons, but most often in the evenings, probably to bars. There was very little in the way of alternative entertainment in that corner of the state. The nearest picture house was in a town called Corinth. There had been a vaudeville theater in Tupelo, but it had closed many years ago. The couple tended to come back late, sometimes after midnight, after the train had passed. Sometimes the suitor would stay an hour or two, but to their certain knowledge he had never spent the night. I asked, "When was the last time you saw her?" "The day before she died," they said. "She had left her house at 7 o'clock in the evening. The same suitor had come calling for her right at the top of the hour, quite formally." "What was Janice wearing that night?" I asked. "A yellow dress," they said, "knee length, but low cut." "Did her friend show up in his own car?" I asked. "Yes," they said, "he did." "What kind of a car was it?" "It was a blue car," they said.